Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, so I wanted to start with my own remembrances of V, and I'm realizing one advantage of age is that I got to experience him firsthand. Although I find it really beautiful that he lives on in many younger economists through building on his ideas. So I met him when I was a newly minted PhD, and many of the comments resonate because he was inspiring, also a little bit intimidating, but he also just had like this quiet charisma and this kind of mischievous smile. And he was encouraging, even though I wasn't one of his students. So I really appreciated that because, you know, there's this anonymity when you start in the profession, and someone of his stature to listen to me was truly an inspiration. So his influence is everywhere in my work. This social returns versus private returns. I'm always trying to build spillovers in. I remember having a conversation with Ariel Pacus where he said, "Oh, you need to have those to generate growth." And I'm like, no. We put that in because we think it's there in the data because people like Grillick has told us it was there in the world. The other thing I was going to say is like all the stuff about product quality and product variety, you're going to see it in this paper here and my other work. And so the only thing I've done that doesn't reflect V's influence is on sticky prices, and that's just like temporary insanity on my part. Okay, so the title, Aroma Ricardo, is a deliberate mix of growth and trade. So apologies to Philippe if you're wondering why it's not Roemer or versus Aguillon. It could have been, but that would have made it sound like it was just growth. So we're deliberately, you'll see, trying to combine growth and trade, maybe overly ambitiously. We were coming at this. This is with Chiang Kai-shek and Kazuatsu Shimizu, a graduate student at MIT. So we're coming at this partly from the growth literature saying there's like these two tracks in the growth literature, the quality ladder stuff, Aguillon and Howitt, for example, and then the variety stuff like Roemer. And then we'd look at the trade literature and say, wow, they have the same two tracks, but in a static trade sense. They've got the Krugman Mellitz track with varieties generating trade, and then the classic Ricardian and more recently Eaton and Cordham that has these quality differences or process efficiency differences. So we're like, that's interesting that these parallel tracks exist. So in the same way that Chiang and I have tried to, in the growth literature, say how much growth is coming from new varieties versus quality improvements, we thought, well, how much trade is coming from different varieties versus quality differences and Ricardian differences? So that's what we're about. And that's why we wanted the alliteration of Roemer or Ricardo, but we also wanted the mix of trade and growth in the same title. Okay, so I'm going to be kind of breezy on this because the paper's got a lot of moving parts, not necessarily a good way. But the basic ideas are, at a point in time, you have trade because of differential varieties and trade because of more than one country has access to producing the same variety, but somebody's going to take over each market, which is like more of an Eaton Cordham. So we got Mellitz, Eaton Cordham at the same time. And we've got growth through those sources too, introducing new varieties versus quality improvements. And we got these knowledge spillovers built in, especially across countries. Countries are going to build on each other. So that's the, I'm skipping the why do we care slide because I feel this is like a safe zone where we're all kind of on board that we care about something like is it a new variety versus a quality improvement. But one of the key reasons we care is if there's knowledge spillovers or business dealing effects associated with creative destruction, as many people have mentioned. Okay, so this is an integrated model because the sources of static trade are coming from the dynamic sources of growth. So if a country is introducing a lot of new Roemerian varieties, it's going to be doing a lot of Roemerian trade, a lot of Mellitz type trade. And if it's doing a lot of creative destruction, then it's going to do a lot of Ricardian trade in the cross section. This is an integrated model, so the fact that everybody's building on each other means that the countries are going to grow at the same rate. But you have differences in income. The innovative countries, the countries that have a lot of new varieties or a lot of quality improvements will be rich, and the countries with lower rates of those will be less rich. Okay, so how are we going to take all this stuff and try to put some empirical discipline on it? we're going to do something very much in the spirit of what Daniel was just talking about, but a lot less direct inference. So he had 10-digit product level data. We would love to have that for even 20 countries in the world for like exports and imports. We're going to do something much more indirect, but it's the same basic intuition as his right tails, which is we're going to say if a country starts exporting a lot in some category, we wish it was really narrow, but then we're going to infer that it's either introducing a new variety or it's taking over some varieties. And then how are we going to distinguish then creative destruction versus new variety creation? Well, we're going to look at the import side. So if it's replacing something that it used to import, you should see its imports fall. Again, at the product level, we'd love to see it directly. We're going to try to infer it from the distribution, same way that he was talking about the distribution of revenue as opposed to seeing product level. We're going to look at the distribution of exports and imports and look for this right tail behavior as coming from these extensive margins of introducing new varieties. But to give you the intuition that I'm going to repeat a couple times in my 15 plus minutes, think of like Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, leading exporter of semiconductor chips. They're not importing. Taiwan is not importing as many chips as they used to before they started producing a lot of these advanced microprocessing chips. So you'll see them explode over a certain time in the sample, introducing new exports in that category, but at the same time you'll see their imports in that category falling. So we infer they're building on things that were done out there. But you do see a bunch of them still importing, so we're going to infer that they're doing a lot of new variety creation as well. Okay. Static portion of the model. So any point in time, we've got, it's not quite nesting Melanchthon Eaton Cordham. To do that, or Eaton Cordham, more exactly Bernard Eaton Jensen and Cordham, we decided not to exactly nest them. We're nesting Melanchthons, but we're not nesting BEJK because they had endogenous markup dispersion, which is fascinating and out there in the world, but it was just, we have enough stuff going on, so we just killed that and just have, even though you've got these heterogeneity and quality steps, everybody's got the same markup for simplicity. But picture, we've got the typical things like fixed cost of exporting. We also have fixed cost of production. We've got variable cost to exporting to various countries. And then at a point in time, then we've got what we're calling a Romerian trait. A Romerian thing is if only one country has a blueprint for producing that variety. And Ricardian is if more than one country can produce that variety. But we're going to have that Eaton-Cordham element of in any one market. If more than one country can produce a product, still only one country will take over that particular market. So you could have this Dornbusch, Fisher, Samuelson thing where because of trade, two countries are producing the same product but only serving the domestic market, or the best of those two is able to capture both markets depending on the trade costs and the quality difference. Okay, so one of the things we get from this unified perspective, though, is this endogenous distribution of TFP that I was alluding to earlier. Okay, this is just to show you there are equations. We do formalize this. Obviously, I haven't defined any of these terms, but picture we've got growth in each economy. It's going to be the same in every country. Every country is going to grow the same because of this kind of knowledge spillovers, but the levels will be different, and we can ask in each country how much growth is coming from. So you could have, for example, all growth in a country coming from new varieties and all growth in another country coming from creative destruction. So we're going to decompose growth into quality improvements versus new varieties, but we could just as easily decompose it into domestic innovation and foreign sources of innovation. So that's another thing we like about this is that, you know, if another country comes up with a new variety, that benefits us. Or if this one's maybe more controversial, we have a frictionless model in terms of employment, so the China shock is nothing but a good thing because they at least provide cheaper versions of products that you get to enjoy. So it's as if you have access to a better variety. Okay, so we can do things like decompose growth country by country into types of growth, quality ladder versus varieties, and also domestic innovation versus foreign innovation, as well as say in the cross section, does a country export a lot of new varieties or export a lot of things that it built on from other countries that they created? Okay, so how are we doing the inference? I already described it briefly, but let me describe it again. We're going to look at the distribution of export growth and the distribution of import growth, and particularly positive export growth versus negative import growth. And we're going to say the right tail, I guess maybe I'll just go to a figure. So the disappointing thing is that, sorry, wrong direction. Disappointing thing is we're using 4-digit to be able to look at 20 countries or more. We're looking at the biggest 20 countries that are responsible for like 95% of trade. We're kind of disappointed that the aggregate level we were able to do that at, it's about 4-digit. So nothing like the the 4,000 products, closer to, 400 products than 4,000. So we have a lot of aggregation. So we're going to have to do a lot of indirect inference. We can't directly see this stuff. So we're going to look for thickish tails, not literally the plus two, minus two that Daniel is referring to. But let me just skip over. This kind of picture is the distribution of export growth. And you can see there's a lot of plus two action in both China and the US. So how can we distinguish who's coming up with the new varieties and who's creatively destroying existing ones? We're going to look on the import side. Not dramatic difference. We don't see a lot of, negative two, but we see a lot more mass, a lot less mass in the right, in the close to zero in China versus the US. So the US doesn't slash its imports of a lot of things. So that's like saying we have big export surges in the United States, but we don't have import decline. So it doesn't look like the United States is replacing much of anything that it's importing with domestic varieties. Whereas China has much less of the mass, close to zero, so it's doing a lot of things where it slashes its imports by a fair amount in a four-digit category. So we're inferring from that China does a lot more creative destruction and the US does a lot more new variety creation. Okay, so the pattern, this is the key empirical plot. So if I didn't show you anything, this is the thing to show you. And this is purely data. So all we did was say large export growth is plus one to plus two, and large import decline is minus one to minus two. And you see the striking pattern. We've got TFP from data unrelated to trade on the horizontal axis, US normalized to one. And you see on this left part here, you see what's happening is large import declines are much more likely in poor countries, lower TFP countries, and much less likely in high TFP countries. So the US isn't alone in that picture I showed you. They're like Canada, EU, Japan, Australia. You're seeing the pattern. And up in the upper left tail is like India, Indonesia, China. So the idea of slashing your imports and maybe replacing it with something you export is something cheap labor costs lower developing countries do. Again, very intuitive, but it's jumping out at the data in this very indirect inference. And if you think about large export growth, that's what rich countries do. They don't do a lot of import declines, but they do plenty of the large export growth. So you look in the right tail, you see the US, Canada, Japan, EU again in the upper right, in the lower TFP countries in the lower left. So we're going to infer there's nothing in our model that forced us to find this in the data. This is what in the data is going to make us infer that rich countries generate new varieties and relatively lower TFP countries imitate them with some sort of lag. So that's where we're heading. Okay, so it's those of you who know the Grossman-Helpman north-south models, and Krugman had a version of that too, this is very much in that flavor. So you might say, hey, we knew that from the north-south product cycle papers, but those were purely theoretical papers. We're trying to make this empirical and quantitative, and we're finding very much in their spirit. We didn't know we would, but we're allowing that. We could have, in the model, we allow developing countries to introduce new varieties. We're just not seeing patterns in the data that suggest that. We easily could have found that they don't do a lot of creative destruction and they introduce new varieties, but like really low quality ones, and that's why they're relatively low TFP. That's not what we're finding. Okay, so I'm skipping over. Maybe too ambitious, 87 parameters. If going from 9 to 15 was, you can imagine maybe we're going too far here. But if you think about it, we got, three types of arrivals of innovation. We got all these trade barriers. We got 20 countries. So, yeah, maybe we'll see what Timo thinks of this. So one key thing we learned out of this, though, which I should have known, it's like, I'm always like, Zvi-Gerlikas plus 30. Like, I figure out stuff that I read from his with the lag of like 30 years. Oh, by the way, another Zvi anecdote. When I first taught second year of PhD growth, I was like, I got to read this Gerlikas hybrid seed diffusion. I've never read it. I was blown away. It was like 50 years old at that point, and it read like it could have been written at the time that I was reading it for the first time. I was like, this is incredible. So anyway, so it takes me a while to learn stuff. I'm Gerlikas plus 30. I'm Cordon plus at least 10. So, but here's another one. I just kind of had to figure out in our own model that once you say that there's fixed cost of production per labor, then variety growth has to be pinned down by population growth. And so then you get love of variety, but we get an extra term from these variety growth because the new varieties come along and drive out lousy varieties because of this fixed cost of production. So new varieties create, directly add to variety growth, but that's constrained by population growth. That's the first term. And that gives us like 0.3% per year of growth. But we get another kick from the fact that they're above average quality relative to the marginal ones they drive out. So we get like 40% of growth just from this equation. Obviously, the second term is very endogenous in the model. What I got, five?
No, you've got, I haven't lifted it yet.
Okay.
I haven't shown it to you yet.
All right. So we're getting 40% of growth from new variety creation on average in the world. Only 10 percentage point of that 40 is the direct effect of net variety growth from population growth. The other 30% percentage points is this selection issue, that they're better than the marginal stuff they drive out. Okay, so here's, I'm unlike anybody, I'm not running into constraints.
You're doing fine.
Okay, so this is like a key, you know, there's no standard errors on this, so that's fair. I guess I'm partly inspired by a presentation that I saw Kevin Murphy give, where he was using census data and somebody asked for standard errors, and he's like, standard errors? I've got no standard errors. My standard error, sampling error, my standard errors are coming from model misspecification. So we don't know if this is the right model. Of course, it's not the right model. So these are just more of like a quantitative illustration that this method, this is what we came up with. So most growth, we're saying, only 40% of growth comes from new varieties. Own innovation is countries improving the quality of what they're doing, and innovation on imports is this building on each other through the import process. So the green is basically China. So we're saying a bunch of growth in the world comes from China coming up with, you know, maybe lesser quality, but still very cheap, very cheap versions of stuff that was invented elsewhere. And then what are the blue is the United States. So the blue has a big role. The United States has a big role in new variety creation. Also tends to improve the varieties. You see other advanced economies are doing a lot too. They're doing all three. The innovation on imports, that's going from the US to like other advanced economies coming up with versions of what the US do. So creatively destroying. And then it goes to the green China and the orange other emerging economies. So you see this nice mix of like where growth is coming from in the world. So that's also something that's different from the pure north-south model, is we're getting a lot of innovation coming from outside the richest countries. Okay, so one of the things that I'll say Chang really likes about this is that there's not a dichotomy between, well, there is a dichotomy between Romerian and Ricardian products, but there's also the process of products becoming more Ricardian over time. So this is the age of the product in our simulations and the number of countries with the blueprint. On the right, you can see it starts with one country that comes up with a new variety, and then that knowledge spreads through this imitation process that we're estimating so that, you know, granted, a century later, seven countries can produce it, but it's becoming more Ricardian over time. So the Romerian share of a product as it ages is falling systematically, very much in the Grossman-Heltman north-south spirit. You also see something interesting out of this model, which is that when products are first developed, because of the fixed cost of exporting, this Melitz component, they go first to the biggest markets where you can sell the most of it. And only then, when it gets improved over time and becomes a better quality product, is it worth introducing into smaller markets. This is very Eaton Cordham Cramars-esque here. You see, in the model, as the products age, they penetrate to the average GDP. The size of the GDP of the destination market is shrinking. So again, it's like the biggest market gets served first, and then eventually it diffuses from the consumption side to smaller markets, which we think is kind of cool. Okay, this is just showing things going from the U.S. to other advanced economies. So if you thought it was always the U.S. versus developing countries, there's this product cycle even within the North. That's also something you don't get out of Grossman-Heltman. Okay, so my remaining couple minutes, let me say, again, there's huge standard errors on this because of the model misspecification. All models are wrong. I'm a big fan of that. But it was just fun to produce numbers like this and think about them. And to me, they don't seem crazy. But let me say, from a marketing point of view, like what was I ex ante wanting? What was I rooting for? It would be like, they all matter. Like everything matters. Romer's right. Aguillon Howitt's right. And Cordham's rights, Mellett's rights, so that anybody who wants to do any of those things gets to cite us. So that they all say, yeah, they're all important. Okay, so we kind of find that. So if you look at it, 43% of growth comes from new products. That's like saying 43% from Romer, 57% from Aguillon and Howitt. And you might say that's bigger than your 15 to 25% number, but this has incumbents improving their product too. You had process innovation for incumbents, that could be product innovation, quality innovation. So we're including that in our other sources of growth. So it's kind of like 50-50-ish, 43-57. And you could also say, how about growth from domestic versus abroad? On average, we're saying 44% from foreign innovation, 56% from abroad. That surprised us that it was so high, the domestic sources, and maybe it's because we have these big trade barriers to explain why there's not that much trade. Now, it is more important for the smallest countries, it's up to 90%. They get most of their ideas from abroad. The U.S. is an outlier. It gets most of its growth from these new products and not that much growth from abroad. And then in the cross-section, the trade share, this is a little farther from 50-50 than I wanted. We're saying Romerian mellets is a third of trade, and two-thirds is Eaton, Cordham, Kramars, let's say. But for the U.S., it's like 87% of our exports are Romerian. We're like the sole producer of that variety, and only 1% for China. So China is a heavy imitator, a heavy build on other people. And again, the global product cycle was what I described. Okay, I'll stop. And
thanks so much. Yeah, great job.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to discuss this work. Which I liked a lot. So kind of the first impression I got when I read the paper was, wow, this is actually a cool model. So I sort of really appreciate the theory as a first thing on its own, because in a way, the ingredients are not far-fetched at all. So we all know those models where you can put growth into the expanding variety, you can put it in a quality ladder. We know the two motives of international trade. Here it's just put together, so the ingredients are not fancy or far-fetched, but I haven't seen it being put together in this way, and then out comes a very rich framework that gives you very rich predictions. So as I said, we have both comparative advantages and varieties as motives of trade and sources of growth in this model. So then what comes out of it is endogenously, we explain the long-run growth rate at the world level. It's not that just one country is the leader and pushes the frontier, but it's jointly pushed by all countries. So all countries contribute to the growth at the global level. Out comes prediction about relative income levels, which country is rich, which country is poor, along this balanced growth path. Then you have rich prediction about the composition of growth, because there are those different type of innovations. You have a rich prediction about the composition of trade, because there are those different motives of trade. And finally, there is a very rich prediction about the product cycle, that one country first comes up with a new variety, then other countries start producing it as well, and you have this product life cycle. Eventually, maybe the product will disappear. Of course, this is reminiscent of this north-south trade models, but here it's not kind of hardwired which country innovates. It's kind of in the end let the data speak. So it's very rich predictions. Okay, and then of course they don't stop there. They use the comprehensive trade data and this framework as an accounting device to quantify those objects. Good. What are some main findings? Maybe I shouldn't repeat that for too long. So there are many findings, but some of the most salient ones is U.S. Grows mainly for creative destruction, creating new varieties. China mainly for creative destruction. Small countries, if you look at the composition of growth, mainly benefit from innovation abroad. And finally, the product life cycle typically moves, which I found quite interesting, typically moves from the U.S. to other rich countries before it moves to China and other poor countries. Okay, good. Just some underlying assumptions that are imposed on this framework, and for some of them I had some thoughts or questions. Does it affect the quantification in the end? Of course, balanced trade is assumed here. in the data it's not balanced. I mean, they did trend stuff in a way. I as a reader, I was just not sure. Probably it's not a concern, but maybe it is. Constant markups, that's kind of simplification. Of course, when you think about the reality, well, one way how innovation abroad might affect firms, the local firms here, is maybe not through sales, but also that they restrict how much markup they can charge. That is not captured. Then what I had a bit of a harder time to wrap my head around is trade in intermediate inputs, because this is important in the trade data, intermediate inputs. Here it's basically all final output, final consumption goods. You can easily think that suppose French car manufacturing shuts down, then this has all sorts of implications about also imports of France, not only exports, of course, car exports might drop, but at the same time, maybe also tires and other parts, the imports of France collapse at the same time. This will not be captured here, and I couldn't wrap my head around it, how it affects the quantification, and of course a little bit it would be the burden is on the offers to tell me is this a concern or not. Finally, no changes in tariffs, so tariffs are kind of the trade costs are constant, and over this time period there have been some changes. Good, let me speed up a bit. One nerdy theoretical point, which was about the cutoff decision of exports. Here it's just a trade-off between the profits you can make and the fixed cost. Then if the profits you can make as an exporter in a destination, you go there and send it, sell there. In this model, if the agents would fully understand the framework, they should actually modify this cutoff rule a little bit, because they should internalize that if they export to a particular destination, there is a risk that this destination creatively destroys your variety. So if it's only epsilon the margin, you might actually not want to export to a particular destination. Indirect inference. This is kind of the method that is applied, which I generally like a lot. Of course, what is the main challenge about this method is there is a gap between you write down a model and then you have some moments and then you push a button and out comes a bunch of parameters. And this gap is in this paper a bit larger than in others, because there are just 90 parameters or 87 as we saw. Of course, I mean, the offers do a great job at helping me understanding what a data moment pinning down which parameters with examples of two countries and just allowing for one channel of motive of trade and growth. However, there are also some little bit puzzling results I saw, and for me it wasn't possible to really figure out what's going on. One is actually, if you compare, there are a lot of numbers here, but if you just compare, what did I do? If you just compare China China and other poor countries, on the top panel you have the data moments. They look relatively similar, but then if you look at the estimated parameters down here, they look very different. So you see kind of domestic production with the lander is 2% in China and other poor countries 51. Okay, wow. Then you look at the new products, 0.8 in China, 22 in other poor countries. So the other poor countries look much better in creating new varieties than the other rich countries like the European Union. So given that the moments looked relatively similar, I had a hard time to see where is it coming from, and of course curious to know where it's coming from, this difference. Good. Another point I thought about is, of course, there is this kind of striking finding about the China shock. Suppose you would replicate, and this is kind of, maybe it seems at first at least to me, a bit at odds with this story that the product cycle is actually from the US then to other rich countries like European countries and then to China. So I was wondering if you would feed in a China shock in this model. Would you get as well big effects on the US economy or not? Yeah. 1 minute. I mean, Pete said that they're going to look into more detailed microdata, and I think that, of course, has big promises, and I think will help a lot to inform the exercise. I think there is a lot to learn from it. One is, there is, of course, this awkward moment in the paper where we have to go from products to export categories, and it's a bit, if you can avoid this, that's great. And then, of course, related to the markups, the micro trade data might also give you physical quantity, not only sales, but also physical quantity, so you could at least check whether something happens to prices as well. Bottom line, this is great paper, great work. I really like it, and I'm sure it will have a lot of impact. Last line is, it's also interesting for me when I thought about it, actually trade economists might say, oh, I don't care, I get my gravity equation out of both motives of trade, varieties or Ricardian comparative advantage. Here it's kind of connected with growth, and in the growth literature I think everyone agrees that we care about, we have a clear reason why we care about the different source of growth, so whether it's variety or creative destruction, because there is this business dealing effect. So there is actually also a good answer. No, also the trade people should care. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good.
Do you want me to respond directly or open
up? Up to you. I mean, if you want to just take comments, we can.
So I just wanted to say one thing clarifying. So I agree with everything Timo said, all completely fair. I was going to add that one limit of the study, if you're wondering how do we do all this, one important limit is that we're just backing out arrival rates that we are estimating. We're not endogenizing those. So we can't do any like policy counterfactual of change the tariffs and ask how the innovation rates change. So in addition to the trade people saying, why do we care about this paper at all? They would naturally say, you can't do any counterfactual. A lot of people reacted, you know, this is just not frontier because you're not endogenizing that stuff. So let me just say, in the spirit of Grillikas, we're doing some accounting, right? And growth accounting isn't theory-free and model-free. You need constant returns to scale and competitive input markets, for example. We need some assumptions. We've got some market structure, maybe more assumptions for growth accounting, but that's what we're trying to do. But there are limits to it. Yep, I'll open it up.
Great.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.